turkey processing plant in northern Wisconsin. They say they're running out of turkeys and I should report immediately. I'm going to be talking today about largely about joint work with Mark Culler. And the theme of this work ties in with both with the talk that Dave Gabay just gave and also with some of the earlier talks in the conference about such as Steve Kirchhoff's about the project of really getting an intimate understanding of the connection between the geometry and the topology of a three-manifold. One thing that I think maybe distinguishes our approach is that we're using very heavily techniques from the purely topological theory of three-manifolds, which have been developed over the last half century and which are very dear to my heart. So I think it's fun to see this playing a role in hyperbolic geometry. So let me begin by stating a theorem. This theorem has a slightly complicated history. It was proved under an additional hypothesis by Anderson, Canary, Culler and myself, actually about 15 years ago. But in the present form, it also uses the Marden conjecture, which was proved by Egal and Caligari-Gabay. Suppose you have say orientation preserving isometries of hyperbolic 3 space, so we can think of that group as PSL2C. And suppose that these elements generate a free group of rank K. That's equivalent to saying that they generated freely. I think the last time I gave this talk when Dick was here, I said no parabolics, and he insisted that was irrelevant, so I won't say it. So then, let's see, a free group of rank K, but it has to be discrete. That's crucial. Then, for every point P in hyperbolic space, the following inequality holds. We take the sum as I goes from 1 to K of the quantity 1 over 1 plus the exponential of d sub, I'm going to denote this d sub xi of p, so that's just the distance. In general, for any isometry x, this simply means the distance that the point p gets moved by x, by the element x, the displacement. So it's the hyperbolic distance from p to its image under x. And this sum is less than or equal to a half. As an immediate corollary, under these hypotheses, we have d xi of p greater than or equal to log of 2k minus 1 for some I. Between 1 and k. Now, so this proof is sort of saying that if a group is I mean, it belongs to a whole class of theorems that begin with Jorgensen's inequality that says that if, that say that if a group is discrete, then you're sort of saying how discrete they have to be. But what distinguishes this one from other results of this type is the hypothesis that, that the group is free. This would not be true at all without the hypothesis. And so what I want to do is, first I want to spend a few minutes just kind of chatting in very general terms about what goes into the proof of this, just so you'll see why freeness is important. And then the rest of the talk is going to be devoted to applications of this to results about volumes. The game that you have to play is that in order to apply this theorem, you have to have topological ways of recognizing that certain subgroups of a three-manifold group are free. And philosophically, that's really where all the three-manifold topology is coming in. So that's kind of a synopsis of where we're heading. So I'm not going to give even anything that would be called a sketch of the proof of this, but I just want to spend a couple of minutes kind of giving the philosophy of why freeness is important. And the story starts with an observation that certainly came up in the proof of the Banach-Tarski paradox, or the key point part of it, which was done by Hausdorff, and it's played a role in lots of things since, such as dynamical systems. And it's just the following observation about a free group. So suppose F is free on generators x1 up to xk, so everything can be written uniquely as a reduced word in these generators. So of course it'll involve the x's and their inverses, which I'll denote the inverse of x1, for example, by x1 bar. You can decompose F as a disjoint union. So you can partition it into subsets, let's call them SX1, SX1 bar, up to XK, SXK bar, and the identity. This is a disjoint union, and what's meant here by these sets is that SX, where X is either one of the XIs or XI bars, simply means the set of all reduced words beginning with X. So their leftmost letter is X. Now, the observation that makes this interesting is that if you take one of these sets, for example, xi, and you multiply it on the left as a subset of the group by xi bar. So this is the set of all things you get by taking elements in xi and multiplying on the left by xi bar. Of course, what you do that is, what happens when you do that is you cancel the xi, so you have a shorter word that's everything to the right of xi, and what that can be is any reduced word which does not begin with xi bar. If the thing to the right of xi were xi bar, it wouldn't be reduced. So what you get when you do this is the complement relative to f of the set S sub xi bar. Okay? So the idea that I guess Kohler and I first had, and then it was extended in our work with Anderson and Canary, was that you could combine this observation with the theory of Patterson-Sullivan measures. Now, a Patterson-Sullivan measure is a measure on the limit set of any Kleinian group. So if gamma is any Kleinian group, there's a certain measure, I'll call it mu, it's not quite canonical a priori, but it's a measure on the limit set. Lambda of gamma. And it's nice. It transforms in a way that's somewhat like the way area measure transforms, for example, in the case when the limit's set with a whole sphere, but there's a slight difference. The area measure transforms according to a change of variable law, an integral formula which involves the square of the conformal expansion factor of an element. That's the Jacobian in this case. And this, in general, does something slightly different. It transforms, instead of according to the square, it involves a dth power where d is the so-called critical exponent of the group. So that's part of the theory of this. But what's especially interesting from our point of view is the way this is defined. It's actually defined by as a weak limit. Mu is constructed as a weak limit of measures supported on an orbit of gamma. So an orbit of gamma, of course, is a subset of hyperbolic space, whereas the limit set is a subset of the sphere at infinity. Well, you can think of those both as living inside the ball, which is the union of hyperbolic space and the sphere at infinity. And so you can think of these all as measures on that set. And it turns out that it's in the nature of weak limits that you can have a weak limit of a sequence of measures that are supported inside hyperbolic space, but their limit is supported only on the outside. The limit set, which is actually the set of accumulation points of the orbit. And furthermore, the measure on the each measure on the orbit in the sequence, it's a sum of a certain quantity. I'm not going to write down what the quantity is, but it's a sum over the elements of the orbit of certain delta masses, of certain point masses. So summed over the orbit, but of course the orbit, I mean, this is a free action, so the orbit is, yeah, let's say it's a torsion-free Kleinian group, so it's a free action. The orbit is precisely parametrized by the elements of the group. So in fact, it's some kind of sum over the group. So the idea that Keller and I had is that in the case when the group is free, you can actually free on these generators x1 up to xk, you can replace this sum by, instead of taking a sum over gamma, you take the sum over s sub I of the same thing. You do the same construction, and you get a collection of you get a measure for each I, a weak limit that's constructed in the same way. And so, roughly speaking, if mu is this Patterson-Sullivan measure, it has a decomposition as mu 1. So you have measures mu x 1 plus mu x 1 bar, and so on up to mu x k plus mu x k bar. So these are constructed as weak limits of things that are the sums of the same point masses only over an orbit. And then you form the weak limit in the same way. The one element set doesn't contribute because it's too small. So it actually contributes zero to this sum. So you get a kind of an analytic counterpart of this combinatorial partition of the group. Well, the reason this is useful that's why they're interesting. They're surprising. It's surprising that they exist. They come from the structure of the free group. In other words, this corresponds to the fact that the whole group is the union of these disjoint subsets. It translates that. And now the point is we can also translate that formula up there. Again, I won't write it down, but it says that it's either the pullback or the push forth. I'm incapable of keeping track of the difference. The push pullback of let's say the pullback of mu xi via either xi or xi bar, whichever it is, is Well, how would you translate that formula? Well, it would be mu minus mu xi xi bar. And so so in particular, the total if you look at the total mass of this, you get and pull it back, you get the total mass of this. But pulling it back involves, as I mentioned a minute ago, integrating, well, for mu xi as well as for mu, involves integrating this dth power of the conformal expansion factor. So you get something like, you get a formula that's something like the integral of lambda xi to the d, and as I say, I'm not sure if this is xi or xi bar, against mu xi is equal to 1 minus the total mass of mu xi bar. You get some formula like that. Now the point is that this conformal expansion factor is given by an explicit formula. I mean, there's a completely concrete thing. The conformal expansion factor on the sphere at infinity of a Möbius transformation, and it turns out that if you take your point P to be the center of the ball, making these measures well defined involves a certain choice of a coordinate system. So if you take P to be the center of your ball in your coordinates, then in fact lambda xi is actually an explicit expression in the very quantity that we're interested in studying, namely the displacement of the point P under xi. So then the idea is you try to do some analysis, and using this information, you try to get restrictions on these displacements, like the inequality we're looking for. Well, this thanks to the Marden conjecture, that works very well in a special case, namely in the special case where the limit set is the entire sphere at infinity. It turns out that mu is simply normalized area measure. And basically what you do is you take this formula armed with the fact that the sum of these is just mu, so in particular these are bounded above by normalized area measure. So if you like, they're Radon-Nikodym derivatives with respect to normalized area less than or equal to 1. And you do some elementary arguments involving plain old calculus, among other things, and you get this inequality. So that's for the special case where the limit set is the two-sphere. The point is that tameness, the geometric form of tameness in Canary's interpretation says that in fact that it gives you a kind of ergodic properties for the action on the limit set, which in this case is S2, and that's enough to imply this. Well, what about the general case? And that's kind of an exotic case when the limit set is the whole sphere. It's not the situation you first think of for a free group, but it turns out that there's a very simple deformation argument that says that's the worst case. So in other words, you can actually in fact reduce the more reasonable-looking case to this extreme case, where the limit set is the whole sphere, and that's how the argument works. So as I say, the main point of that discussion was to show you why freeness should play a role at all in something like this. And now what I want to talk about is how you can apply that by using topology and you can get actual geometric information about closed three manifolds by knowing that certain subgroups of their fundamental group are free. So many of these applications involve the notion of displacement cylinders, and this is basically our way of thinking about, well, it's a way of thinking about the Margulis tubes, but it actually is more general. So I'll give a self-contained discussion of it. So we're going to be interested in closed manifolds in this talk. So let's say M3 is closed, hyperbolic, orientable, and I guess that'll be a standing assumption for the rest of the talk. So we write it as quotient of hyperbolic space by gamma, where gamma is discrete group that's isomorphic to fundamental group, co-compact, particularly has no parabolics, so those won't be an issue if they ever were. And so for each maximal cyclic subgroup X of gamma, I can associate a subset of H3, which I'll denote. Oh, and for let's also suppose we're given a positive number lambda, which is arbitrary. Then there's a set that I'll denote Z sub lambda of X. This is the set of all points in H3 such that, we have to be a little bit careful here, so such that for some X, some non-trivial element X in X, it, not necessarily a generator, because there's some tricky things that happen because of twisting around the axis. For some non-trivial element X in X, the displacement of P under X is less than lambda. I call this a cylinder because it's actually it's a metric neighborhood of the axis of the common axis of the non-trivial elements of this maximal cyclic subgroup. So by metric neighborhood, I simply mean there's a certain constant R which depends on lambda and on the parameters of the generators of X, such that it's simply the set of all points whose distance from the axis is less than that R. So it's a cylinder in that sense. So to for example, if X and Y generate a rank 2 free subgroup of gamma, then it follows from the theorem over here that if I take the log 3 displacement cylinder about, let's say X is the subgroup generated by X and likewise Y. So if I look at the log 3 displacement cylinder of X, that's actually disjoint from the log 3 displacement cylinder of Y. So the point is, if you had a common point in this, then after replacing X and Y by suitable powers, you would know that at that point was displaced less than log 3 by both these elements, and the corollary up there says that that doesn't happen. It's the corollary when k equals 2. So this suggests that we should be able to get some geometric information about the manifold if we know something about two-generator, about free rank 2 subgroups. And so this is where the first hint of topology comes in. So it's a theorem that was proved, I guess, by Jaco and myself, and independently by Tom Tucker, that if M, well, okay, so M will satisfy all the hypotheses. Of course, we didn't use the word hyperbolic when we first proved it because you only need topological information about M, which is now believed to be equivalent to hyperbolic, but it certainly follows from it. So if M is if M has the property that pi 1 of M has no Rank two means generated by most two by two elements. Rank two subgroup. The rank is the minimal number of generators of a group. Rank two subgroup of finite index. Then, in fact, any two non-commuting elements in fact generate a rank two free group. Okay. So under this hypothesis, it now follows that z log 3 of x intersect z log 3 of y is actually empty, in fact, whenever x and y are distinct maximal cyclic subgroups, because it's an easy algebraic property of these groups that maximal cyclic subgroups, that they're element, a non-trivial element of one never commutes with a non-trivial element of the other. And so in particular, these cannot cover hyperbolic space. That's a bit of Poinsett topology. If they're disjoint, they don't cover because it's connected. And of course, they're proper open subsets. So because they don't cover, we can pick a point. Let's call it P, which lies outside all these things for every x. So we pick a point P which lies outside all of them, and then it follows immediately that P is displaced at least log 3 by every non-trivial element of the group, and therefore P projects to a point in M, which is the center of an embedded ball of radius log 3 over 2. And if you're into numerology, as I am, you wonder why the number log 3 over 2 comes up here, as it did in Dave Gavai's talk, and I've been wondering about that for many years, but it seems like a kind of a incomprehensible thing. So, or a coincidence or something. So it projects to the center of an embedded ball of radius log 3 over 2 in M, and then using the kind of ball packing estimates that Dave alluded to, which are due to Budrichsky and Florian. In fact, you can get lower bounds for the volume, which are strictly bigger, in fact, than the volume of a ball of radius log 3 over 2. So, in fact, via ball packing, this implies that the volume of M is bigger than something like 0.92, and then you can, in fact, improve that by working much harder. And these are the results that Dave mentioned earlier versions of, due to Kuller and Hersonsky and myself and Przeworski. These results can, in fact, be made much stronger using tameness. So in fact, what you and Przeworski, you can in fact refine this argument to show in fact that the volume of M in this case is greater than the weak's volume. So in other words, you can state as a theorem, if you like, that minimal volume M implies that pi 1 of M has no subgroup, has no free subgroup of finite index. Well, you may or may not consider that topological. But in fact, Wagreich and I showed that has no sorry, this is completely inside out and backwards, has a two-generator subgroup of finite index. Thank you. So Wagreich and I showed that the ranks, you can relate the ranks of subgroups of finite index in a three-manifold group, and this is essentially just Poincaré duality, as it turns out, and some very interesting group theory involving ideas of Stallings. You can actually use this to get homological restrictions. So in general, if there's a K-generator subgroup of finite index, then if you look at the first homology with mod p coefficients for any prime p, the rank of that is at most k plus 2. So in this case, H1 of m with mod p coefficients, k plus 1, in fact. So this must, in fact, have rank at most 3. Another way of saying it is if H1 has rank at least k plus 2, then any k generator subgroup has infinite index. So yeah, the logic is always a little tricky with these things. And of course this obviously implies, by the way, the statement that Dave mentioned, which is that the rational homology has rank at most 2. But yes. That what? Is a two-generator subgroup of what? No. No. Maybe we should save this for the question period. I don't think so. Speaking of, I think you just mentioned Hegel and Dunfield, which is right on the subject, because Keller and I were able to soup this up, further, I guess, using Hegel Dunfield, Keller and I showed that in fact. Let's put it this way: that if the volume of M is less than 1.219, then H1 of M Z mod P has rank at most 3. So I should say this uses Hegel Dunfield, and it also uses other results of Przeworski's about tube packing. And the proof of this is a Dane surgery. It's a Dane surgery argument. So a Dane surgery argument. So you take out the shortest geodesic and you do a Dane filling and you use the fact that arguing by contradiction that still has rank at least 4, then there's a somewhat different application of this theorem that allows you to get information, and then you compare that with the volume of the original manifold by this Hegel and Dunfield argument, which also involves this. Okay, so. And by the way, Hegel has several partial improvements on this, which I won't attempt to state because I probably messed them up, but involves some very remarkable ideas. So, let's see. So that's the story. That's sort of an indication of the kind of thing you can do with two-generator subgroups. When you get beyond that, things actually get much more interesting. So let me suppose for the moment that, well, actually I should state a theorem, which again is. follows from the results in our four-person paper together with Egel and Caligari-Gabay. Suppose that every subgroup of rank at most 3 in pi 1 of m is free. And of course, obviously, it can be free of any rank it wants to be as long as it's less than or equal to 3. Then, in fact, M contains an embedded ball of radius log 5 over 2. And this is stated in a way that makes it look just like the other one, and you might even think, if you didn't think about it too hard, that you could prove it by exactly the same argument. So we said, I mean, in the other situation, every subgroup of rank at most 2 was free, and we got a ball of radius log 3 over 2, where 3 is 2 times 2 minus 1, and this is 2 times 3 minus 1. Well, how would you try to do this? Well, you'd look at these displacement cylinders, and you'd say, well, if they don't cover hyperbolic space, then you're happy. You get this ball. If they do cover hyperbolic space, it's very easy to get a triple intersection, a point that's in 3 of them. And if the generators of the corresponding maximal cyclic subgroups, if those maximal cyclic subgroups generate a rank 3 free group, well, then you get the same contradiction. Those 3 cylinders can't intersect. Well, everything I just said is true, but it doesn't prove anything. And the reason is that when you have those 3 displacement cylinders meeting, you know that you have 3 distinct maximal cyclic subgroups. Because of this hypothesis, you know that they generate a free group. And because they're distinct maximal cyclic subgroups, it certainly can't have rank 1, but there's nothing to stop it from having rank 2. So actually what you need to do is you need to study the nerve of the covering, and that's a quite different kind of classical topology. This is the nerve in the sense of Czech theory. It's a 2 complex, and you kind of play off the topological properties of that nerve against the algebraic properties of the lattice of free subgroups of the group gamma, which is isomorphic to pi 1 of m. And so the argument is quite involved, but in fact you do get this conclusion. So that's one difference between this and the 2 generator case, is that step is much trickier. And by the way, if you try to go to 4, this argument just doesn't work. We have very partial results for 4, but no real applications yet. There's another difference, however, which is that you'll notice here I was not able to just say, suppose there's no rank 3 subgroup of finite index. I had to say, suppose that there's no free, so suppose that every subgroup of rank 3 is free. Now, that's a strictly stronger thing. It's simply not true that assuming that there's rank 3 subgroup of finite index, no 3 generator subgroup of finite index implies that every subgroup of rank at most 3 is free. What is true is the following proposition. It's kind of a variant on the result by Jaco and myself and Tucker that I mentioned earlier. It's in the appendix of a paper I wrote on 3 free groups with Gilbert Baumslag. And I guess I might as well state it in general. Uh, If we take so suppose that H is an infinite index subgroup of pi 1 of m of rank at most of rank at most k, then either H is free or pi 1 of m contains pi 1 of a closed surface of some genus G, where G, well, I'm always assuming m is hyperbolic, so G has to be greater than 1, and it's less than or equal to less than or equal to k. I must mean k minus 1, I think. K minus 1. Okay. So notice that this means that so if pi 1 of m has no finite index subgroup of rank at most k, then either pi 1 of m is k-free, which means that every subgroup of rank at most k is free, or pi 1 of m contains a closed surface group of some rank of some genus greater than 1, but strictly less than k. Okay. Now, of course, for k equals 2, this case doesn't arise. There is no integer strictly between 1 and 1. For k equals 3, you have the genus 2 surface group. Okay. So if pi 1, let's see. So if pi 1 of m has no finite index subgroup of rank at most three, then either m contains a ball, an embedded hyperbolic ball of radius log 5 over 2, and then by the packing arguments, what you get is, in fact, that you get a lower bound of the volume of 3.08, or pi 1 of m contains a genus 2 surface group. And now, using these results from my paper with Wagreich, then maybe I should call this a proposition. I've seen a proposition starting with so, but why not? And now the corollary is that if volume of M is, say, less than or equal to 3.08, then either, well, I'm going to talk about mod P homology because it's always the most interesting thing, so these may then be non-Hockin manifolds. So H1 of M with mod p coefficients is it's either less than or equal to 4, because if it were at least 5, then that would imply that there's no finite index subgroup of rank at most 3, or else pi 1 of m contains a genus 2, a genus 2 surface group. Okay? Well, okay, so I consider this result pretty unsatisfactory because of this part. And I mean, this is actually, without this part, this would be fairly close to being sharp. I mean, there are examples where this hypothesis holds and this rank is equal to 3. So this is really in the realm of reality, but this, I mean, who knows what this thing means. And so so the really serious topology I'm going to talk about today is involved in getting rid of this condition, but you have to make the other parts a little bit weaker. So a theorem that Culler and I have proved, and I'll state the strongest version of it that we've written down so far. There's a slightly stronger thing that we've been fighting with for a very long time. But so suppose, again, that the volume of M is less than or equal to 3.08, then if I take the mod 2 homology, this is the rank, of course, this has rank, we don't get quite as strong a bound, we can show that it has rank at most 7, and we have some, I mean, by working, I mean, well, I'm going to sketch the proof of this very vaguely in the case when you replace 7 by 10, but we really think we can get this down to 6, and that we have not proved yet. It involves, we've reduced it to a fascinating conjecture about finite two groups, which we don't quite have yet. So, I mean, we've proved it, but it never quite stays proved for very long. So we hope to replace 7 by 6. Okay. But before I go on, I should make one little comment. I stated this proposition, so for those who have been initiated to some three-manifold theory, I should just say that the method of proof is to look at the covering space defined by H and take its compact core. And then what you show is, it's actually very easy to show that H1 of the boundary, that the boundary of the compact core has total genus at most K, and then what you show is in fact that either that's a handle body of genus at most K minus 1, or else the boundary is incompressible. And that's where you get that surface subgroup down in M. Okay. So I just want to give a few hints about the proof of this theorem now. And as I say, I'll give the hints not about the general version, not about the strongest version that we know, but I'll give hints about the proof of the weaker result that the rank is less than or equal to 10. So first thing I want to do is state a purely topological theorem. So, topological theorem, it's topological in the sense that the proof is purely topological. I mean, I'm going to write hyperbolic in the statement, but the proof only uses the immediate topological consequences of hyperbolicity. I mean, M is always assumed hyperbolic, so I won't say that, but it's implicit in the statement. So, suppose that the rank of H1 with mod 2 coefficients is greater than or equal to 11, and that pi 1 of m does contain a genus 2 surface group. So we can assume these things, because otherwise, what we're saying follows from the stuff I'd written down before. So what do we know? Well, what do you expect to happen? I mean, what's the most obvious way that this can happen anyway? It's that you have an actual embedded genus 2 surface in the manifold, and pi 1 of the surface injects into pi 1 of the manifold. That's expressed by saying it's incompressible. But in fact, you get, well, in the version of the theorem I'm going to write down, you get something slightly weaker, namely that M contains an incompressible surface of genus, well, either 2 or 3. Now, the actual conclusion of this is stronger. I'll sort of mention the stronger statement when I'm sketching the proof for you. But if you have this topological theorem, so now to prove the geometric theorem, let's call this statement star, that under those hypotheses the rank is at most 10. So to prove this statement star, it suffices to consider the case when M does contain an incompressible surface of genus 2 or 3. Okay, well now, now we need to use some other heavy machinery due to Agel, Storm, and Thurston. Which, like the result of Agel and Dunfield that Dave and I both mentioned, uses Pellman's estimates about the Ricci flow with surgery. So I am putting my money on that, and it's needed for the proofs of these theorems. I should have mentioned that. So what Agel, Storm, and Thurston prove, this is a special case of their result, which I'll state, is that if M, which is hyperbolic, contains an incompressible surface, I guess I can use F now. It's been a long time since I mentioned the free group. If M contains an incompressible surface F, and of course it's understood to be orientable, it's part of the definition here, and closed, and pi 1 injects, as I said, and it's not a sphere, okay? Then either the volume of M is greater than a number which is a little over 3.66. I think it's the volume of an ideal regular hyperbolic octahedron. So either you get this lower bound for the volume, in which case, of course, we're in great shape. We have a contradiction to the hypothesis. Or M is what Culler and I called a fibroid, which means that it means that each component of, I'll denote by M sub F the manifold of the boundary that I get by splitting M along F. So its boundary is a disjoint union of two copies of F. So each component of that manifold M sub F is what's called a book of I bundles. A book of I bundles is exactly what you think it is. Any questions about that? You take a collection, a disjoint collection of circles, and then you take a disjoint collection of compact surfaces with boundary. You take the disjoint union of those, but then you attach the boundaries of the surfaces to the circles by say covering maps. You get a certain polyhedron that way, and if that thing lives in a three manifold, then its regular neighborhood is called the book of I bundles. And the surfaces we should always take, in this case, have negative Euler characteristic. So the pages, the circles, of course, are the bindings, and the surfaces are the pages of the books. So I should say that the pages have Euler characteristics strictly less than zero. Well, what happens when you do have a book of I bundles? Well, in the situation we're concerned with, the surface has small genus. So if you have a book of I bundles, you know, there's not very much homology there, and so you can use Meyer-Vietoris essentially to bound the homology of the original manifold. So just by elementary arguments of that kind, this actually implies that that the rank of H1 is at most, I think it's 7, as a matter of fact. Well, of course, that's all we need is 10, but to apply the topological theorem, we needed to assume it wasn't less than or equal to 10. So, I mean, this is more than you need to get the conclusion in this case. Okay. So well, how do you prove a topological theorem? Like, how much time? I'm not sure what time I started. Oh, well, then I can talk 5 minutes. Okay. So how do you prove a topological theorem like this? Well, it's very much in the spirit of Dehn's lemma, which was proved by Papakyriakopoulos, but then a simplified proof was given by Shapiro Whitehead. And apart from all the strange homological stuff, this is like Dehn's lemma. Dehn's lemma says that if you have Dehn's lemma, or the fancier version involving the loop theorem, says that if you have an essential singular disk in a manifold with boundary, a three-manifold with boundary, which then you have an essential embedded disk. Well, you can think of this hypothesis as saying that you have an essential singular surface of genus 2. So you can take S to be a surface of genus 2, and then we have a pi 1 injective map from S into M. It's injective, it induces an injection on pi 1. What Shapiro and Whitehead do is they take the image of a certain of the neighborhood they take a suitable neighborhood of the image of this map, and then they take a covering space of it. So we can think of this as mapping into some submanifold N in M, which is a suitably chosen neighborhood of its image. In their case, it's a regular neighborhood, but we have to do something fancier. And then you take a two-sheeted cover of this, which I'm going to call M1. I call this M0. So I think of this as the base of a tower. This is the next stage of a tower, and then you repeat the process. And eventually it stops, and then you see what you get up at the top of the tower, and then you try to push it down to get information down in the manifold. That's what they do with a disk. That's what I'm doing. That's what Culler and I are doing with this genus 2 surface. So the details of this topological argument are extremely involved. They use lots and lots of machinery, which has been developed in the decades since Papakyriakopoulos and Shapiro Whitehead. So I just want to give one or two hints about what happens. So at the top of this tower, we have a manifold M sub N. We have a map of S into it. The argument divides into two cases, depending on whether the fundamental class of S maps non-trivially into H2 of MN or not. If it maps trivially, it's not hard to show that if you take a regular neighborhood of the image, its boundary contains a surface of genus 2. And we set things up very carefully in constructing our tower so as to guarantee that that surface is incompressible upstairs. when the image of H, the fundamental class, is non-trivial, it turns out that you can use Gabay's results based on sutured manifold hierarchies to get a surface of genus, an incompressible surface of genus 2 there as well. So you get some kind of incompressible surface of genus 2, and now you want to start trying to push that thing down the tower and see what you get. And it turns out that what comes up here again, coincidentally, is this notion of book of I-bundles. Namely, what you do inductively by a sort of downwards induction from mn to mn minus 1 and so on is in each, successively in each m sub k, you find not an embedded surface, but a book of I-bundles let's say W sub k with boundary W sub k incompressible, and the Euler characteristic of W sub k is equal to minus 2. Now, if you can do that, now it's pretty trivial to do that in M sub k. You just take a neighborhood of this incompressible surface, okay? And that has these properties. It's a kind of degenerate case of a book of I-bundles. It is an I-bundle, in fact, a trivial one. But when you try to push that down, the thing you can put it in nice position up here, but when you push it down, it intersects itself, and it's easy to see that the neighborhood of the image is a book of I-bundles in that case. To do the other steps is much more complicated. And anyway, you do eventually get this, and once you have this, then if you take a boundary component of this, it's a simple calculation to show that it's of genus either 2 or 3. If the boundary is connected, it's of genus 3. But otherwise, it's two components of genus 2. So, well, what on earth does the homological hypothesis have to do with any of this? The point is that, as I said, it's very hard to go, in general, from mk to mk minus 1. When you push the thing down, even if the image of the book of I-bundles upstairs is a book of I-bundles downstairs, which is itself a huge story, but even when it is, there's no reason it should have incompressible boundary. And what you have to do is you have to compress the boundary. You know, you have to modify the manifold so as to try to make its boundary incompressible. There's all kinds of stuff involved in that, but if you've ever done any cutting and pasting, you know that one thing that can go really terribly wrong here when you're compressing a surface is that it can just disappear. Which means one way that can happen is that, for example, you might add a handle body or something like that to the complement of this thing when you were compressing it, and instead of a book of I-bundles, you'd have the whole manifold. Well, you know, these things, at the last stage, if you're going from stage mk to mk minus 1, then at stage mk, you knew exactly what you had. You knew you had this book of I-bundles with chi bar equals 2. The homology is completely controlled. There's a certain amount of control over the homology in mk minus 1 as well. And if it did compress to get the whole manifold, that would give you a bound on the homology of the whole manifold, on the rank of the mod 2 homology of the whole manifold mk minus 1. And it would also tell you that mk minus 1 is closed. And the stuff with Wagreich that I mentioned earlier says that when you start taking covering spaces, finite sheeted covering spaces, I mean, if MK is closed, it's actually a finite sheeted covering space of M. If it's a finite sheeted cover of something whose homology has rank at least 11, in fact, that result shows that its homology is going to have rank, at least 10. But in fact, it turns out that this bad situation where compressing the boundary gave you this whole closed manifold as replace this book of I-bundles by the whole closed manifold, in that case, the homology would have a rank at most 9. So that's the contradiction. So you need a more delicate topological theorem to prove the full result. And as I said, you get into extremely complicated things when you're trying to go from 7 down to 6. So what I didn't talk about, although it was in my notes, was there are also results where instead of modulo suitable conjectures, instead of just getting conclusions about homology, you can get conclusions about Haygard genus. So, for example, we have a proof modulo suitable conjectures, very far from being an actual proof, that you can take this case of the topological theorem I proved, this case of the geometric theorem I proved, which is that with this bound on volume, with this bound on with this bound on volume that the rank is at most 10, you can prove a Hagar genus, you can, quote, prove a Hagar genus analog of it. So it's only a conjecture, of course, but it would say that if the volume of M is less than 3.08, then the Hagar genus of M is at most 10. This would involve proving, first of all, the famous conjecture that for a hyperbolic manifold, the Hagar genus equals the rank of the fundamental group, but it would also involve a new conjecture, which I think may very well be true, which is that if the Hagar genus is G, then for any finite sheeted cover, the Hagar genus has at most is at most G minus 1. And with those same conjectures, you could also take that 1.219 result, and you could also prove that if the volume is less than 1.219, then H1 has rank. Then the Hagar genus is at most 3. So I consider this very fascinating motivation for pursuing these questions about Hagar genus, which are very firmly rooted in classical topology, and it may well be that they'll be proved by some kind of blend of, you know, geometry and topology, some date in the future. So that's it. No, sorry. What? Oh, yes. Definitely. In fact, anytime you have an automatic structure on a group, in principle, there's something like that you can do. Now, in general, it may get very weak. My student Brian Mosier, in his thesis, in fact, he did get a result like that for surface groups, and